Fifth iteration. The All-Seeing Eye. An afternoon in Horseferry Road, 12th of November 1855. Image recorded by A.G.S. Hullcoop of the Department of Criminal Anthropometry. The shutter of Hullcoop's Talbot Excelsior has captured 11 men descending the broad steps from the entrance of the Central Statistics Bureau. Triangulation locates Hullcoop with his powerful lens concealed atop the roof of a publisher's offices in Holywell Street. Foremost among the 11 is Lawrence Oliphant. His gaze beneath the black brim of his top hat is mild and ironical. The tall, dull-surfaced hats create a repeated vertical motif common to images of the period. Like the others, Oliphant wears a dark frock coat above narrow trousers of a lighter hue. His neck is wrapped in a high choker of dark silk. The effect is dignified and columnar, though something in Oliphant's manner manages to suggest the sportsman's lounging stroll. The other men are barristers, bureau functionaries, a senior representative of the Colgate Works. Behind them, above Horseferry Road, swoop the tarred copper cables of the bureau's telegraphs. Processes of resolution reveal the pale blurs dotting these lines to be pigeons. Though the afternoon is unseasonably bright, Oliphant, a frequent visitor to the bureau, is opening an umbrella. The top hat of the Colgate's representative displays an elongated comma of white pigeon dung. Oliphant sat alone in a small waiting room, which communicated by a glazed door with a surgery. The buff-coloured walls were hung with coloured diagrams depicting the ravages of hideous diseases. A bookcase was crammed with dingy medical volumes. There were carved wooden pews that might have come from a wrecked church, and a coal-dyed woollen drugget in the middle of the floor. He looked at a mahogany instrument case and a huge roll of lint occupying places of their own on the bookcase. Someone called his name. He saw a face through the panes of the surgery door, pallid, the bulging forehead plastered with drenched strands of dark hair. "Collins," he said. "Captain Swing," and other faces, legion, the faces of the vanished, names suppressed from memory. "Mr. Oliphant?" Dr. McNeil regarded him from the doorway. Vaguely embarrassed, Oliphant rose from his pew, automatically straightening his coat. "Are you entirely well, Mr. Oliphant? Your expression was most extraordinary just then." McNeil was slender and neatly bearded, with dark brown hair, his grey eyes so pale as to suggest transparency. "Yes, thank you, Dr. McNeil. And yourself?" "Very well, thank you. Some remarkable symptoms are emerging, Mr. Oliphant, in the wake of recent events. I've one gentleman who was seated atop an omnibus, Regent Street, when that vehicle was struck broadside by a steam gurney, travelling at an estimated 20 miles per hour. "Really? How dreadful." To Oliphant's horror, McNeil actually rubbed his long white hands together. "There was no evident physical trauma as a result of the collision. None. None whatever." He fixed Oliphant with that bright, nearly colourless gaze. "Subsequently, we have observed insomnia, incipient melancholia, minor amnesiac episodes, numerous symptoms customarily associated with latent hysteria." McNeil smiled, a quick rictus of triumph. "We have observed, Mr. Oliphant, a remarkably pure, that is to say, a clinical progression of railway spine." McNeil bowed Oliphant through the doorway into a handsomely panelled room which was sparsely furnished with ominous electromagnetic appliances. Oliphant removed his coat and waistcoat, arranging them upon a mahogany valet stand. "And your spells, Mr. Oliphant?" "None, thank you, since the last treatment." Was this true? It was difficult to say, really. "And your sleep has been undisturbed?" "I should say so, yes." "Any dreams of note? Awaking visions?" "No." McNeil stared with his pale eyes. "Very well." Oliphant, feeling utterly foolish in his braces and starched shirt front, climbed upon McNeil's manipulation table, a curiously articulated piece of furniture that in equal parts resembled a chaise longue and a torturer's rack. The thing's various segments were upholstered in a stiff, engine-patterned brocade, smooth and cold to the touch. Oliphant attempted to find a comfortable position. McNeil made this impossible, spinning one or another of several brass wheels. "Do be still," McNeil said. Oliphant closed his eyes. "This fellow Pocklington," McNeil said. "I beg your pardon?" Oliphant opened his eyes. McNeil stood above him, positioning a coil of iron on an adjustable armature. "Pocklington. He is attempting to take credit for the cessation of the Limehouse cholera." "The name isn't familiar. A medical man?" "Hardly. The fellow's a works engineer. He claims to have ended the cholera by the simple expedient of removing the handle from a municipal water pump." McNeil was screwing a braided copper cable in place. "I'm afraid I don't follow you." "Little wonder, sir. The man's either a fool or the worst sort of charlatan. He's written in the Times that the cholera is nothing more than the result of contaminated water." "Is that entirely unreasonable, do you think?"
"Utterly counter to enlightened medical theory," McNeil set to work with a second length of copper. "This Pocklington, you see, is something of a favourite of Lord Dabbage's. He was employed to remedy the ventilation troubles of the pneumatic trains."
Oliphant, detecting the envy in McNeil's tone, felt a slight and spiteful satisfaction. Babbage, speaking at Byron's state funeral, had regretted the fact that modern medicine remained more an art than a science. The speech, naturally, had been most widely published. "Do close your eyes, please, in the event of a spark being discharged." McNeil was pulling on a pair of great, stiff leather gauntlets. McNeil connected the copper cables to a massive voltaic cell. The room filled with a faint, eerie odour of electricity. "Please try to relax, Mr. Oliphant, so as to facilitate the polar reversal." Half Moon Street was illuminated by a massive web lamp, a fluted Corinthian column fueled by sewer gas. Like the rest of London's webs, it had remained unlit during the summer's emergency for fear of leaks and explosions. Indeed, there had been at least a dozen pavement-ripping blasts, most attributed to the same fire damp that powered the web. Lord Babbage was an outspoken supporter of the web method. As a result, every schoolboy knew that the methane potential from a single cow was adequate for an average household's daily heating, lighting, and cooking requirements. He glanced up at the lamp as he neared his own Georgian façade. Its light was another apparent token of returning normalcy, but he took little comfort in tokens. The physical and more crudely social cataclysm was past now, certainly, but Byron's death had triggered successive waves of instability. Oliphant imagined them spreading out like ripples in a pond, overlapping with others that spread from more obscure points of impact, creating ominously unpredictable areas of turbulence. One such, certainly, was the business of Charles Egremont and the current Luddite witch hunt. Oliphant knew with absolute professional certainty that the Luddites were defunct. Despite the best efforts of a few manic anarchists, the London riots of the past summer had shown no coherent or organised political agenda. All reasonable aspirations of the working class had been successfully subsumed by the radicals. Byron, in his vigorous days, had tempered justice with a well-dramatised show of mercy. Those early Luddite leaders who had made their peace with the Rads were now the tidy, comfortably well-to-do leaders of respectable trades unions and craft guilds. Some were wealthy industrialists. Though their peace of mind was severely perturbed by Egremont's systematic disinterment of old convictions. A second wave of Luddism had arisen in the turbulent 40s, aimed this time directly against the Rads, with a charter of popular rights and a desperate zest for violence. But it had crumbled in a welter of internecine treachery, and its boldest spirits, such as Walter Gerard, had met a distressingly public punishment. Today such groups as the Manchester Hellcats, to which Michael Radley had belonged as a boy, were mere youth gangs, quite devoid of political purpose. Captain Swing's influence might still be felt occasionally in rural Ireland or even in Scotland, but Oliphant attributed this to the Rads' agricultural policies, which tended to lag behind their brilliance in industrial management. No, he thought, as Bligh opened the door at his approach, the spirit of Ned Ludd was scarcely abroad in the land. But what was one to make of Egremont and his furious campaign?
"Good evening, sir."
"Good evening, Bligh." He gave Bligh his top hat and umbrella.
"Cook has a cold joint, sir."
"Very good. I'll dine in the study, thank you."
"Feeling well, sir?"
"Yes, thank you."
Either McNeil's magnets or the devilishly uncomfortable manipulation table had set his back aching. McNeil had been recommended to him by Lady Brunel, Lord Brunel's spine being assumed to have suffered an inordinate amount of railway shock in the course of his famous career. Dr. McNeil had recently diagnosed Oliphant's numinous spells, as he insisted on calling them, as symptoms of railway spine, a condition in which the magnetic polarity of the patient's vertebrae was assumed to have been reversed by trauma. It was McNeil's thesis that this condition might be corrected by the application of electromagnetism, and to this end Oliphant now paid weekly visits to the Scots Harley Street premises. McNeil's manipulations reminded Oliphant of his own father's unhealthily keen interest in mesmerism. Oliphant Sr., having served as Attorney General of the Cape Colony, had subsequently been appointed Chief Justice of Ceylon. Consequently, Oliphant had received a private and necessarily rather fragmentary education, one to which he owed both his fluency in modern languages and his extraordinary ignorance of Greek and Latin. His parents had been evangelicals of a markedly eccentric sort, and though he himself retained, however privately, certain aspects of their faith, he recalled with an odd dread his father's experiments. Iron wands, spheres of crystal. And how, he wondered, climbing the carpeted stairs, would Lady Brunel be adjusting to life as the Prime Minister's wife? His Japanese wound began to throb as he gripped the banister. Taking out a triple-splined Maudsley key from his waistcoat pocket, he unlocked the door to his study. Bly, who held the keys only duplicate, had lit the gas and banked the coals. The study, panelled in oak, overlooked the park from a shallow triple bay. An ancient refectory table, quite plain, running very nearly the length of the room, served as Oliphant's desk. A very modern office chair, mounted on glass-wheeled patent casters, regularly migrated around the table as Oliphant's work took him from one stack of folders to the next, then back again. The casters, in the chair's daily peregrinations, had begun to wear away the nap of the blue Axminster. Three Colt and Maxwell receiving telegraphs domed in glass dominated the end of the table nearest the window, their tapes coiling into wire baskets arranged on the carpet. There was a spring-driven transmitter as well, and an encrypting tape-cutter of recent Whitehall issue. The various cables for these devices, in tightly woven sleeves of burgundy silk, snaked up to a floral eyebolt suspended from the central lavalier, where they then swung to a polished brass plate bearing the insignia of the post office, which was set into the wainscoting. One of the receivers began immediately to hammer away. He walked the length of the table and read the message as it emerged from the machine's mahogany base. "Very busy with particulate fouling, but yes, do visit, stop, Wakefield, end it." Bly entered with a tray of sliced mutton and pickle. "I've brought a bottle of ale, sir," he said, setting out linen and silverware on a section of the table kept cleared for this purpose. "Thank you, Bly." Oliphant raised the tape of Wakefield's message with his fingertip, then let it droop back toward its wire basket. Bly poured the ale, then departed with his tray and the empty ceramic bottle. Oliphant trundled the office chair around the table and sat down to spread his mutton with Branston pickle. He was startled from his solitary meal by the clatter of one of his three receivers. He glanced down the table and saw the tape beginning to unspool in the machine to the right. The machine to the left, on which Wakefield's invitation to lunch had arrived, was on his personal number. Right meant police business of some kind, likely Betteridge or Fraser. Putting down knife and fork, he rose. He watched the message emerge from its brass slot. "Re-F-B. You are required at once. Stop. Fraser. End it." He took his father's German hunter from his waistcoat to note the time. Tucking it away, he touched the glass that domed the centermost of the three receiving telegraphs. There had been no message on that one since the death of the late Prime Minister. The address to which the cab carried him was in Brigsome's Terrace, off a thoroughfare of the sort that speculative builders delighted in carving through the ancient and still largely unexplored wilderness that was East London. The terrace itself, Oliphant decided as he alighted from his hansom, was as dismal a block of buildings as had ever been composed of brick and mortar. The builder who had speculated on these 10 dreary prison houses, he thought, had likely hung himself behind the parlour door of some adjacent tavern before the hideous things were finished.
The streets through which the cab had conveyed him had been those one seemed to traverse at times such as these, all those thoroughfares seemingly unknown to day and the ordinary pedestrian. A thin rain was falling now, and Oliphant momentarily regretted not having accepted the waterproof that Bligh had offered at the door. The two men before number 5 wore long, drooping, black, cape-like articles of waxed Egyptian cotton, a recent innovation from New South Wales, Oliphant knew, much praised in the Crimea, and precisely the thing for concealing weapons of the sort that these two most certainly concealed. "Special Bureau," Oliphant said, briskly climbing past the guards. Abashed by his accent and manner, they let him pass. It would be necessary to report that to Fraser. He entered the house, finding himself in a parlour lit by a powerful carbide lantern atop a tripod, its merciless white glare magnified by a concave round of polished tin. The parlour was furnished with scraps salvaged from the ruins of gentility. There was a cottage piano and a chiffonier, several sizes too large for the room. The latter struck him as pathetically gorgeous with its tarnished gilt mouldings. A threadbare patch of Brussels carpet swarmed with roses and lilies amid a desert of colourless drugget. Knitted curtains shaded the windows overlooking Brigsome's terrace. Beside the glass, two hanging wire baskets were festooned with plants of the cactus species, which grew in prickly and spider-like profusion. Oliphant noted an acrid stench, more penetrating than the reek of carbide. Betteridge emerged from the rear of the house. He wore a high-crowned derby hat that made him seem altogether American, so that he might easily have been mistaken for one of the Pinkerton operatives he shadowed daily. Likely the effect was deliberate, down to the patent boots with their elasticated side gauze. His expression, quite uncharacteristically, was one of grave anxiety.
"I'll take full responsibility, sir," he stammered.
Something was very wrong.
"Mr. Fraser's waiting for you, sir. Nothing's been moved."
Oliphant allowed himself to be led through the doorway and up a narrow, perilously steep flight of stairs. They emerged in a barren hallway, illuminated by a second carbide lantern. Great, spreading continents of nitre marred the bare plaster walls. The burnt smell was stronger here. Through another doorway into yet brighter glare, and Fraser's dour face looking up from where he knelt beside a sprawled body. Fraser seemed about to speak. Oliphant silenced him with a gesture. Here, then, was the source of the reek. Upon an old-fashioned coaching case stood a compact, modern Primus stove of the sort intended for camp, its brass fuel canister gleaming bright as a mirror. Upon its ring rested a pannikin of black cast iron. Whatever had been cooking in this vessel was now a charred and bitterly odorous residue. He turned his attention to the corpse. The man had been a giant. In the small room it was necessary to step over his outspread limbs. Oliphant bent to study the contorted features, the death-dulled eyes. He straightened, facing Fraser.
"And what do you make of this?"
"He was warming tinned beans," Fraser said. "Eating them straight out of the pot there, with this."
With the toe of his shoe, Fraser indicated a kitchen spoon of chipped blue enamel.
"I'd say he was alone. I'd say he managed to choke down a good third of the tin before the poison felled him."
"This poison," Oliphant said,
taking his cigar case and sterling cutter from his coat.
"What do you suppose it was?"
He extracted a cheroot, clipped and pierced it.
"Something potent," Fraser said, "by the look of him."
"Yes,"
Oliphant agreed.
"Big chap."
"Sir,"
Betteridge said,
"you'd best see this."
He displayed a very long knife, sheathed in sweat-stained leather. A sort of harness dangled from the sheath. The weapon's handle was of dull horn, its hilt of brass. Betteridge drew the thing from its sheath. It was something on the order of a sailor's dirk, though single-edged, with a peculiar reverse curve at the tip.
"What is that bit of brass along the top?"
Oliphant asked.
"To parry another man's blade," Fraser said. "Soft stuff. Catches the edge. American business.
Maker's mark?"
"No, sir,"
Betteridge said.
"Hand-forged by a smith, from the look of it."
"Show him the pistol," Fraser said.
Betteridge sheathed the knife, set it atop the coaching case. He produced a heavy revolver from beneath his coat.
"Franco-Mexican,"
he said, sounding remarkably like a salesman.
Ballista Molina cocks itself automatically after the first shot.
Oliphant raised an eyebrow.
Military issue? The pistol was somewhat crude in appearance. Cheap stuff, Fraser said with a glance for Oliphant. For the American war trade, evidently. The Metropolitans have been confiscating them from sailors. Too many of them about.
Sailors? Confederates? Yanks? Texians?
Texians, Oliphant said, and tasted the end of his unlit cheroot. I take it we agree in assuming our friend here is of that nationality?
He'd a sort of nest in the garret, reached by a trap door.
Betteridge was wrapping the pistol back into its oilcloth.
Terribly cold, I imagine.
Well, he'd blankets, sir.
The tin,
sir?
The tin that contained the man's last meal, Betteridge.
No, sir, no tin.
Tidy, Oliphant said to Fraser. She waited for the poison to do its work, then returned, removing the evidence.
The surgeon will have our evidence out for us, never you fear, Fraser said.